This is Fresh Air. I'm Peter Clowney, in for Terry Gross.
Don't you know me, Kansas City? I'm the new Berlin Wall. Try and tear me down. I was born on the other side.
That's John Cameron Mitchell in the character of Hedvig, the transsexual glam rock chanteuse he created for the New York stage, and whom Mitchell now plays in the movie adaptation he also wrote and directed. Rolling Stone called the original Hedvig and the Angry Inch the first rock musical that truly rocks. The film won a Best Director Award and an Audience Award at Sundance. Hedvig's story goes something like this. When she's born in communist East Berlin, she's a he named Hansel. Hansel eventually falls in love with an American GI who offers to marry him and take him to the United States if he gets a sex change operation. Hansel reluctantly agrees, but the operation is botched. All that remains of his genitalia is an unrecognizable bit, which Hansel, now Hedvig, calls the Angry Inch. She's abandoned by her GI and ends up in a trailer park in Kansas. There she starts writing songs and performing them with a band in a chain of family restaurants called Bilgewater's. Hedvig mixes campy patter with bitter stories about the life that got away, and about her search for someone to make her feel complete. It's a quest inspired by Plato's story about the origin of love.
Earth was still flat, and clouds made of fire, and mountains stretched up to the sky, sometimes higher. Folks roamed the earth like big rolling kegs. They had two sets of arms, they had two sets of legs, they had two faces peering out of one giant head. So they could watch all around them as they talked while they read, and they never knew nothing of love. It was before the origin of love.
John Cameron Mitchell, thank you for coming on Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
So for people who haven't seen the play and haven't seen the movie yet, who is Hedwig?
Hedvig, you can say Hedwig or Hedvig. The name came from Ibsen's Hedvig in The Wild Duck, who is the girl that was destroyed by too much honesty. But originally was inspired by this woman that was a German army wife. My dad was a general in Kansas when I was 14, and she was my brother's babysitter, I think. Someone else thought she might have been my cleaning lady. I can't really remember. But she was around a lot, and my friend Brenda and I would go to her trailer, and we realized she had all these, you know, like a different date every day, and, you know, she wasn't even that good looking, and there was something going on. And only years later, we realized she was probably a prostitute. And she was our friend, and she'd give us drinks, and we would sing for her. And she was kind of the very broad inspiration for Hedvig.
So after you had this initial idea, you hooked up with Stephen Trask and his band Cheater, and you worked on Hedvig from there. Where'd it go from there?
Well, that's when we started working at the drag rock club, Squeeze Box, where Stephen was the musical director. And I'd never done drag, I'd never done rock, but I knew I wanted it to be very rock and roll piece, so we kept it in clubs for a while. And it became so popular, the character, that she became the main character, and it was sort of a combination of the origin of love myth, which had a lot to do with the division of self, and the drag club, which was so much about this divide of gender and this fluidity of gender. And I mixed in a bit of my dad's background as the commandant of the U.S. sector of Berlin right before the wall came down. So this divided city was also in the mix, too.
At first impression, what is Hedvig to look at when you first see Hedvig?
She's got a big, blonde, Farrah Fawcett-inspired wig. You know, her fabrics of choice are acid-washed denim and bright colors, and she's some of the, you know, perhaps colors and fabrics you saw coming flooding over the wall in 1989.
And while Hansel's growing up, he's really lonely, and he sort of finds his friends in American glam rock. I think you call them the crypto homos.
Yeah, well, he listens to radio, and Bowie and Iggy and Lou Reed are right up there as much as, you know, Tony Tennille Anne Murray, and we think of her very much as a patchwork person, you know, an exquisite corpse. There's a song called "Exquisite Corpse," which comes from the surrealist artist's game of one artist would draw the head, another would draw the torso, and another would draw the legs, and they'd just sort of see what they ended up with at the end. And she is certainly, you know, ending up looking different than she originally imagined.
What does it mean to the character that Hedvig Hansel was sort of coerced, forced into this sex change operation?
Well, the whole thing is a little bit of a fairy tale. So the kid's name is Hansel originally, you know, and there's this idea of Hansel and Gretel running away from home, and there's any kind of semblance of power is kind of wrested away in order to be free. I mean, actually showing it in Berlin was really interesting, because especially Easterners really picked up on, you know, the idea of the promise of freedom, and then suddenly the wall comes down and, you know, you're screwed suddenly. Hedvig is, you know, metaphorically, emasculated and when masculation is equated with power, and forced to identify himself as a woman. It's not really a transsexual's story of a coming of age. It's really a disempowerment in his case.
I'm Peter Clowney, filling in for Terry Gross. My guest is John Cameron Mitchell, writer, director, and star of the film Hedvig and the Angry Inch. He also wrote and starred in the off-Broadway musical on which he based the film. I think, well, let me ask you this. I mean, you said you wanted to make a movie musical unlike most that you'd ever seen, but possibly like the stuff that you've seen by Bob Fosse, Bob Fosse's movies being things like All That Jazz or Cabaret. So what is it that you wanted to take from him?
Fosse, I remember seeing All That Jazz in high school, and then later Cabaret, and I just loved the first of all, the sense of reality. You know, this wasn't Singing in the Rain, where you know you're not in the real world. All That Jazz really freed me up when I realized that when there's a really strong central character, each scene can almost have its own style. If you're establishing that it's seen primarily through that main character's eyes. And each scene in Hedvig has its own style. You know, one scene is all close-ups, one scene is a lot of animation, another might be highly realistic, you know, one camera, handheld. Some of the songs are traditional fantasy numbers, like at the end of All That Jazz, sort of happening in his head. And other scenes are motivated in scene, such as, you know, like something like Nashville, where they're performing in that space. I thought about how real that felt, and wanted to do a lot of the vocals live, shoot them live for the camera, which is what I did for about half of the songs in Hedvig, which requires multiple cameras so you can edit well, which makes it a little more expensive, but, you know, then you don't have to lip-sync the punk rock.
Well, one thing about the Bob Fosse movies that I was thinking about, in All That Jazz, there's a lot of huge spectacle, but it's often in the service of something very sad or uncomfortable, you know, something that's going to, that really pulls on the audience rather than being a kind of a release. And I see that in Hedvig too. I mean, there's a song from the show called Wig in a Box that becomes this kind of spun out trailer park spectacle in the movie, much bigger than it could possibly be in a theater. And I think it serves the motion of the song to push it out that way, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly has a melancholy underneath. She starts the song at the lowest point in her life and probably ends it, you know, on one of the highest points of her life. And that's probably the biggest production number. It was kind of shot moment to moment. You know, we knew we'd end up with the trailer exploding, you know, and becoming a stage, which is what happens at the end, because that's something you have to prepare. But even that came out of a certain spontaneity. I wanted the whole trailer to actually just blow up, and, you know, our budget, my production designer was like, I can give you one wall coming down. And we were like, well, I guess it really should be a wall becoming a stage, you know.
I want to play some of the song Wing in a Box. Let's listen to that.
On nights like this, when the world's a bit amiss and the lights go down across the trailer park, I get down, I feel at, feel on the verge of going mad, and then it's time to punch the clock. I put on some makeup, turn on the tape deck, and put the wig back on my head. Suddenly I'm Miss Midwest Midnight Checkout Queen, until I head home and I put myself to bed. I look back on where I'm from, look at the woman I've become, and the strangest things seem suddenly routine. I look up from my vermouth on the rocks, a gift wrapped wig spit in the box of towering.
That's Wig in a Box from Hedwig and the Angry Inch. We'll be back with John Cameron Mitchell, writer, director, and star of the film, after a break. This is Fresh Air. I'm Peter Clowney, filling in for Terry Gross. My guest is John Cameron Mitchell, writer, director, and star of the film Hedwig and the Angry Inch. I know you went to a whole lot of different schools because you were kind of an army brat. So what was your high school experience like, and how does that come through Hedwig?
Well, the beginning of high school was in St. Xavier in Junction City, Kansas. We were at Fort Riley, the Army base nearby. And there was no theater. It was like the school, there were two high schools, the public and that one. And everybody who got kicked out of the public had to go to the Catholic high school. So it was highly mixed. It was the unwed mothers. It was the, you know, the Mexican immigrants. It was the Irish families. It was the general's son. It was, you know, my girlfriend in junior high was a black girl, and she turned me on to, you know, Parliament Funkadelic, and it was a really, really mixed, fun place. But, you know, there were like 12 people in our classes, you know, in our entire senior class, and no theater. There was no money. There was only money for sports because it was a Catholic school, after all. Then we went to Albuquerque, where there was a little bit of theater, but again, a Catholic school, so the drama teacher, Miss Heron, who directed me in a Pinter play, you know, in junior class, you know, gave up because she just hated the principal, and there was no theater again. So I had to get my mom to direct something, and you know, the talent show, I had to choreograph something, you know, an interpretive dance to a Fleetwood Mac song, and these were things that I just felt I had to do.
What Fleetwood Mac song was it?
It was Sisters of the Moon. Of course, Stevie Nicks was singing it, and the performance involved a slow motion crucifixion and scourging. I mean, it was a Catholic school, so we had to have some sort of a nod. And we didn't win. We didn't win. The girl who sang the theme from Arthur and played the flute won. But you know, Hedwig never won either. So it's all sort of a piece. And I was very Catholic as a kid, you know, I was very religious. And some of Tommy Gnosis, who's Hedwig's lover, who becomes the rock star, his religiousness sort of comes out of my experience. And his name Gnosis comes from the Gnostic Gospels, which he interprets, you know, the Genesis myth of Adam and Eve, that Eve is the knowledge giver and was sort of the cool one in the equation. And that's a very Gnostic view of Genesis. So there's a little bit of Plato, a little bit of Gnostics, a little bit of Socrates in there. You know, if it was on the internet, you could, you know, have a hyper click there and go to the Gnostics.
Have you ever had anyone look at Hedwig and then find out that you were raised strict Catholic and say, oh, figures?
Probably. I mean, you know, Hedvig does have all the marks of the Catholic girl. You know what they say about Catholic girls. She's certainly a rebel. Actually, I went back to my boarding school, and I went to boarding school when I was 10 in Scotland, Benedictine boys' school, and I went back to the priest there, who I realized, of course, was a giant queen only in my adulthood. And I said, you know, I've become an actor. And he said, well, I'm not surprised. So I think it's the people who were there who aren't surprised more than those who might not have been there. I was in San Francisco, and someone ran up to me at a screening and said, I'm your ex-girlfriend's sister from Junction City, Kansas. And she just wanted me to tell you that she just saw Hedvig in Kansas City in a screening, and she went with her girlfriend, and they loved it. So, you know, it all comes around at the end.
When you realized you were gay and decided you really had to come out, what was that like? Was it traumatic? Did it happen over a long time?
Oh, it happened over a long time, and it was the 70s, so I wasn't really, there were no real role models, but I was, you know, reading John Ritchie and William Burroughs and such, and it seemed very sort of scary thing, but I knew eventually I'd come out once I felt more comfortable, and I got away from home and the military and the Catholic thing and slowly, you know, traveled the world and realized it was all there was all kinds of people around. And senior year of college at Northwestern, I came out and traveled across Europe, and it was scary too because it was the beginning of AIDS as a very visible thing, and so it felt very political in a way to come out too. And it was a serious thing, but it was also very, you know, changed everything. It you know, gave me all kinds of confidence. It made me able to do things I had never done before. Even physically, I felt more coordinated, more relaxed. You know, I was able to get into all kinds of music, and punk rock suddenly appeared. And it's funny what something like that can do.
It's like a passport to something.
Yeah, and actually it happened in San Francisco when I was visiting my brother at college in his frat, and I sort of had to get away and met a guy who was an auto mechanic, and he drove me away on the back of his motorcycle to Berkeley, and I disappeared for the weekend. And I came back to my brother, and he's like, "What? Where were you? And who are you?" He knew something had happened, something had changed, and it was very exciting.
So now that Hedvig is wrapped and the film is opening, what are you going to work on next? What's next for you?
Well, I've been working in the interim when Hedvig wasn't happening on a children's story for film, which is I'm writing with a guy named Julian Koster, who is involved with some bands down in Athens, Georgia. It's a collective of bands called Elephant Six. And his stuff is very childlike, but in the more European, you know, Roald Dahl, J.M. Barrie children's story, where language is very important and sound and music are very important. And that's called The Grandma Phone. You know, it's about this, well, it's a complicated story. But working on that, it'll be sort of a dark, you know, probably kind of big budget children's film because it has a lot of animation in it, and I don't know if I'll ever get the money unless Hedvig does well, but that's okay. And then there's something else that I'm just, you know, bouncing around in my head that would be a much smaller thing, probably in video, that all I know is that it will make you laugh and it will make you cry and it will have tons of explicit sex. And it would be, you know, not like some of these French films lately, because it will be good sex. It won't be bad, alienated, degrading French sex. So that will probably involve workshopping with actors for a long time. You know, maybe the actors will have to be, you know, lovers. I don't know if, you know, boyfriend, girlfriend, or two boyfriends, two girlfriends. I'm not sure yet. All I know is that the sex, you know, might be the beginning and the whole relationship, you know, and the sex, how it develops through a relationship. But it'll be a real story, and it'll be somewhat improvisationally acted
Why do you want to do that? Why do you want to do that?
Well, I haven't seen sex used in that way. I've seen it used as shock value in art films, and it's never erotic. You know, it seems to, and I actually am sort of interested in really good porn films that almost move into narrative and move into a place that's very moving. and very funny, because as we all know, sex can be very funny, can be very moving, it can be very boring, it can be degrading, and it can be highly satisfying. But just something like really, something I really haven't seen.
Well, John Cameron Mitchell, I really want to thank you for coming on Fresh Air.
You're welcome.
John Cameron Mitchell is the writer, director, and star of the new film Hedwig and the Angry Inch, based on his hit off-Broadway rock musical. I'm Peter Clowney, and this is Fresh Air.